Tell me when the tape's on.
Yep.
All right. Good afternoon, the Senate Judiciary Finance Division will come in to order here. Here's some budget presentations today. I will note that there is a Capital Investment Committee joint hearing over in the House at 12:45, so we may lose a couple of members to that joint committee of Senate and the House. But we will go forward with the entire agenda today. I'll note that there is a quorum present. And we'll jump right in with the Peace Officer Standards and Training Board budget overview. So welcome to the committee. Make sure you state your name for the record and go ahead and give us your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chairman Latz and members of the committee, my name is Nathan Gove. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Peace Officer Standards and Training, commonly referred to as the Pulse Board. Seated to my right is Mary Bjornberg, who is our continuing education coordinator and was the interim executive director from last July until November 10th of this past year when I took over as executive director. Seated directly behind me to my left is Mr. Dan Boydum. He is our budget officer for the Pulse Board. And it's my understanding that you have a copy of the agency profile, and I'll refer to that information as I proceed.
Members, that's in your three-ring binder that's in front of you. Mr. Gove.
Mr. Chair, the Pulse Board was created by the legislature in 1977 and actually came into effect on July 1st, 1978. Minnesota was the first state to switch from a statewide police academy training model to an occupational licensing system with college-based degree programs. Minnesota continues to be a nationwide leader in producing some of the best educated and most highly trained officers. Agencies outside of Minnesota regularly come to Minnesota to recruit our officers away, both officers who have yet to start with an agency and those currently employed. As part of the enabling legislation and language in 1977, the legislature also crafted our mission, which is to enhance the profession of law enforcement in Minnesota through the selection, licensing, and regulation of peace officers. And this is no small task, given that there are currently 444 law enforcement agencies in Minnesota with over 10,500 actively licensed officers. So why the change? One rationale is the state has a vested interest in professional and consistent police practices statewide. All citizens deserve the very best in public safety services, no matter where they live, in greater Minnesota or the Twin Cities metropolitan area. And training for the law enforcement profession in Minnesota begins in the college classroom, where there's been a partnership between higher education and law enforcement. Students earn either a 2 or 4-year degree in law enforcement or criminal justice studies. Minnesota has 32 professional peace officer education program locations throughout the state. We also have a number of tracks to ensure veterans who want to become licensed as officers, as well as officers from outside of the state who are currently working, or someone with a degree. There are a number of large agencies that have cadet programs to get people licensed as officers. The results then is Minnesota set the standard for all entry-level officers having at least a 2-year college degree. And a study by Metro State in 2008 showed 48.9% of currently working officers had a 4-year degree, which was up from just under 30% in 1990. Today, officers patrolling the streets in Minnesota with advanced degrees is not uncommon. I myself am a product of this system, starting my career in 1985. The Pulse Board then, as an occupational licensing and regulatory board, performs a unique public service by providing key service strategies to our stakeholders. If you look in the small agency handout. I do have a list of the full list of services that the Post Board provides. But we accomplish this through our regulatory component. But we're also a resource to our stakeholders, which are quite varied, from peace officers, the licensees themselves, to the legislature, the governor's office, citizens, the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, and other entities with vested interest in the professional delivery of law enforcement in Minnesota. Post regularly meets with these groups to fulfill our parallel role as a resource concerning law enforcement profession in Minnesota. As I spoke to in your small agency profile, one of our key services, obviously, is licensing and relicensing the over 10,500 officers in Minnesota. Some additional key service strategies for us. We write and administer licensing exams, both the regular exam for students coming out of college, interstate reciprocity, and military reciprocity. Concerning the military reciprocity exam, in fiscal year 13 and 14, we did 97 exams. But all told, we average over 1,000 exams per a year, the Post Board, per fiscal year. We also monitor agency compliance with mandated policies and procedures. We monitor compliance with continuing education requirements of officers. We conduct on-site compliance reviews of police agencies. The past fiscal year 13 and 14, we did 89 on-site reviews. We monitor compliance with standards of conduct, and we manage a training reimbursement fund that in fiscal year 14, 401 agencies were reimbursed a percentage of their officers' training costs. For that year, they self-reported to us just over $28 million in total cost to their agencies and political subunits, about just under 9,000 officers. And at that time, the reimbursement was $321 per officer. As of last week, 444 police agencies in Minnesota that range in size from one officer to over 800. And approximately one-third of the agencies in Minnesota have seven or less officers. And only 16 have more than 100 officers. As you can see, this is a challenge for Post to be both a regulator and a resource for agencies with such diverse capabilities and resources. Since 1990, over 135 law enforcement agencies in Minnesota have consolidated, contracted for service, or disbanded. And Post continues to monitor that trend. Post agency staffing, currently we have 10 employees, down from 15 in 2001. Our staff positions are myself, the executive director, a testing and licensing coordinator, two standards coordinators who do the on-site compliance checks statewide, our pre-service education coordinator, continuing education coordinator for officers, and an office services supervisor, and some office administrative support for our walk-in traffic, phone calls, and sort of the resource part of our mission. Concerning our board, there actually is a Post Board. It's 15 members, are appointed by the governor to four-year staggered terms. We have only one ex officio member, that is the BCA superintendent. And a very specific category of the board makeup down at the bottom is that one elected official from a community outside the metro area with a population less than 5,000, and that is currently the mayor of Winsted, Minnesota. Post is funded through a special revenue account from a surcharge on certain criminal and traffic convictions. No direct tax money. The original surcharge from 1998 was $25, And while the surcharge has grown to $77, post share is based on the original 25. And of that $25, 1% or 25 cents goes to the DNR for training, 39% or $9.75 to post, and $15 or 60% to the general fund. And of course, the legislature sets our budget. And of the amount that post does receive, 73 to 75% or 2/3 goes back to local units of government through our training reimbursement fund to help offset costs that they have for police training. As I mentioned, in fiscal year 2014, it was just under $322. A low in 1998 of $316 and a high in 1989 of $477. And I would refer you to handout number 2, which shows our share data back to 1995. And certainly it's impacted by the amount of revenue that is in the account that is brought in and the number of officers that agencies put in for reimbursement. They must have worked for the agency for at least 8 months in the preceding 12 months to be able to have some reimbursement. So we reimbursed just under $3 million on about $28 million in total statewide law enforcement costs for fiscal year 14. Post's total budget is made up of the original special revenue account, second special revenue account that was approved during the 07 legislative session that created a non-DWI reinstatement fee of $20. By this slide, it's estimated at $250,000, but recent estimates show it'll be about $220,000. And that is deposited, those funds are deposited directly into the training reimbursement account. And it can certainly fluctuate based on the number of people that are having their license suspended for failure to appear or unpaid fines and actually choose to go and get their driver's license back. And in fiscal year 11, this account generated $417,000. And as I said, it's estimated to be at $220,000 this year. So that is declining. The reasons, it's hard to determine if there have been changes in policy as to why people get their license suspended or how often that's occurring or whether they're deciding to go and get their license back. There's also several one-time appropriations for specialized training. The $100,000 is for sexually exploited and trafficked youth training put on by the Ramsey County Attorney's Office. And those funds are passed through the post board. And then $50,000, a one-time appropriation in an e-grant for crisis de-escalation strategies for veterans that is put on by the Upper Midwest Community Policing Institute. So as you can see, 2/3 of our budget goes to reimbursing training costs for agencies in Minnesota and 1/3 for our general operating budget. And I would just like to say, Chairman Latz and members of the committee, that I appreciate the opportunity as the new executive director to come before you and give a presentation. This is new territory for me dealing with the legislature, but I'm very honored. The police profession in Minnesota does have high standards and training that is second to none, in my opinion, to the rest of the country, and I'd be happy to answer any additional questions.
Thank you, Mr. Gove. Were there only going to be presentations by Mr. Boytum and Ms. Bjornberg if there are questions, or did they have something additional they wanted to say?
They do not, unless there are questions specifically for them.
Senator Champion.
Thank you for the information. Can you tell me what sort of education happens around or on behalf of those who have mental illness and or communities of color when the police are interacting with those two demographics?
Mr. Gove.
Mr. Chair and Senator Champion, I am aware that many of those items are covered in pre-service training and that there are no mandates by the Post Board for that training specifically. I am aware that many agencies provide that in their ongoing in-service training, but there's not a mandate on that.
Mr. Chair, just
Senator Champion.
And it's my understanding when you use the term pre-service, you're talking about before a police officer receives a license, is
correct?
That right?
In their education college setting.
In the education college
Senator
setting.
Champion.
And so would you be so kind as to provide for me or the committee what sort of training, you know, happens once a person receives their license? And then I think that will fall under your continuing education coordinated services. So if you could provide that information and where it happens, that would be helpful.
Mr. Gold or Mr. Turner, the amount of money that goes into the training fund, is that determined by our level of appropriations to that specific fund? Or is that sort of a combination of what's available and what your operating expenses are in particular? Mr. Boytum.
Mr. Chair, Dan Boytum. I'm the fiscal officer for the Post Board. The training reimbursement fund is appropriated by the legislature to the Post Board, except for the non-DWI reinstatement fee. Whatever gets collected on with regard to that particular receipt is used for training reimbursement as well.
Do we have a separate line item appropriation for the training reimbursement fund specifically, or are those decisions made by the Post Board?
Mr. Chair, those are specifically stated in the appropriation law.
Would you repeat that? I understood that the $2.734,000, which is training reimbursements to local governments, that we define in our appropriation what that is training is to be?
Mr. Turner.
Mr. Chairman, members, we'll just back up. The Post Board has an annual base budget of, I believe it's $3,870,000. And then the annual base budget for training is, as Senator Sharon said, $2,734,000. That number is specifically stated in the rider that the legislature will put in the crime bill. It is not put on our spreadsheet. I can if you'd like. Anything above and beyond the base of 2734, for example, last year the $50,000 for the de-escalation grants is listed both as a rider in the bill and on the spreadsheet. And because that's an addition to the base, and it will cost the general fund, even though this is considered special revenue fund, any money that doesn't flow to the general fund that goes to the Post Board, I will carry on the bottom of my spreadsheet as a general fund adjustment. So if you would like, I could break out the training reimbursements on the spreadsheet, but they are specifically stated in the bill.
Okay. I think it would be helpful to have it on the spreadsheet as well.
And, Mr. Chair, can I ask a question that's consistent with that? So I think I heard the testifier say two things. One is that there's no mandated services or training that has been articulated by the legislature around, you know, a training for how police interact and deal with folks who have mental illness or, you know, special culturally sensitive training, you know, for officers who are dealing with, you know, large populations of people of color. And then I heard staff say that usually if there are services articulated in the bill, that in the appropriation that says here's the training that we will reimburse you for. So if we wanted there to be additional training around mental health or how police are trained with dealing with folks who have mental illness and or communities of color. Would we put that in the bill and that becomes a part of it so that when they seek reimbursement for training that that's a part of it, or am I off base?
Mr. Turner?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Champion, the board can speak for itself, but I think that the $2,734,000 as a base relates to common continuing education. And any specific training, the legislature usually explicitly puts in the bill, both in text and then includes an additional appropriation for it. So in this case, well, for example, last year, legislature put in $50,000 for veteran de-escalation training. This year, if you'd like to put in more for dealing with the mentally ill or dealing with communities of color, that would go in as a rider, and then the money would be whatever you determined it to be. But I think that the base, and the board can speak to it, I think the base itself is pretty much already spoken for on what are state mandated training requirements.
Mr. Chair and Senator Champion, that is true in that Minnesota requires 48 hours of continuing education credits every three-year cycle of relicensure for active officers. And the only areas that are mandated would be emergency vehicle operations and pursuit driving type training every 5 years, use of force training, not only in firearms qualification, but in the tools and the tactics that the officers are authorized by their department policy to utilize. So that's true where the money is based on the needs of the communities, of the agencies, and the training that the chief law enforcement officer determines that officers should receive, and that's where that money is spoken for in the reimbursement, depending on how many agencies actually put in for reimbursement, and most do.
Mr. Gove, where are those mandates contained? The driving training and skills and so on?
In the post board rules through legislative action. Yes, sir.
I mean, to use a through post board legislative action or state legislative?
Well, it has been state legislative action.
So there's a statute somewhere or something that we passed that said,
yes,
those areas that you identified need to be part of the continuing education training for the police officers.
Yes, indeed.
I'm thinking of an analogy because lawyers have a minimum continuing legal education that we have to go through every 3 years as well. And most of that is just a generalized category. It can run the gamut. But there are two subcategories that we have to have at least a threshold number of credits in bias-related training and ethics-related training. Mm-hmm. And so at least theoretically, I suppose the legislature could, or we could direct the post board to take some action, mandating at least a certain amount of training in subcategories, if you mm-hmm. wish to do so, like some of them that are already identified. Would that make sense, Mr. Gove?
Chairman Lantz, it would. And there, you know, when the back concerning pursuit training, that initially was 3 years. And that was changed to five. My understanding is due to some of the financial constraints of greater Minnesota, of the two-thirds of our agencies in Minnesota that are seven officers or less, and the travel time and the scheduling issues. And so the mandated, I think my experience as an officer for nearly 29 years is why that's been limited as to what's actually mandated, as that has typically unfunded costs for small agencies that may not have the resources, and even large agencies. I'm told for St. Paul Police, for instance, to provide mandated training to their staff, an eight-hour course takes 27 days to complete just that one particular for use of force training. And that gets to be a scheduling issue and staffing for the street as well. So, but I hope I've answered that.
Thank you.
Well, I'm just, Senator Mr. Chair, I guess I'm just wrestling with, you know, if the agencies are being reimbursed, I'm not quite sure how it's being defined as an unfunded mandate. Is it from, am I missing something? Because usually unfunded mandate means you're making this declaration or requirement, but they're not getting any resources by which to take care of it. But it appears that the agencies are able to get the training reimbursements, which is in the amount of $2.7 million.
Mr. Goff, do the reimbursements cover 100% of the cost of the training?
Mr. Chair, no, they don't. And the specific appropriations, such as the $100,000 and the $50,000, those are 100% reimbursed. They're not mandated, but they're obviously encouraged, and there's funding for the cost to go along with that. But the general training reimbursement count, it's just a percentage. It's about, in a general term, 10% of what is spent in Minnesota.
So that's when you said there's about $28 million was spent on training. 2.7 of that was reimbursed through this account, and the rest was absorbed by the local agencies?
That is correct.
Any further questions or comments from members of the committee? Anything else you'd like to say, Mr. Goff?
Other than just again, thank you for the opportunity to come before you and give an overview of the post board.
Thank you. Congratulations on your new position.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, we will now hear from the Human Rights Department. So we have Commissioner Lindsay in the audience. Commissioner, why don't you come up with whoever else you wish to make a presentation?
There you go. Have you met Joe King?
Senator Latz, could you guide me to where you're looking in the budget bill?
Yeah, Senator Sharon, the Human Rights Commission, there's a tab called Human Rights that's in your budget book.
Ah, thank you.
Commissioner, welcome back to the committee.
Chairman Latz, thank you. Welcome, members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to address you today as it relates to the budget overview for the Department of Human Rights. Just want to talk briefly on three things: the duties of the department, the operations, and then to end with the department's budget request. Most people are aware that the Department of Human Rights is charged with responsibility for enforcing the Minnesota Human Rights Act. There are three principal duties under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. The first is to investigate and issue complaints of discrimination. The second is to ensure equal employment opportunities exist on all state contracts over 100,000 for workforce. And now it has been amended during the last legislative session as relates to ensuring equal pay is afforded to contractors over 500,000. And then last is to ensure that education, conference, and conciliation is used to eliminate discrimination and disparate outcomes. This point, I think, is relatively significant. Just to remind everyone, is that there is no one federal agency that has the same breadth of responsibility for investigating complaints of discrimination as the Department of Human Rights. And also, it's important, I think, for people to be aware of, is that there are additional protected classes under the Minnesota Human Rights Act which do not exist under federal law. And to that point, as it relates that no one federal analogous agency in the area of employment, it would be the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission at the federal level. Under housing, it would be the Housing and Urban Development. Department of Justice would be taking on issues concerning public accommodations, public services. Department of Justice, Office of Civil Rights for Education would be addressing discrimination complaints in the area of education. So we're in essence trying to reconcile and ensure the federal laws under those specific areas are all reconciled to the extent possible with the Minnesota Human Rights Act, and then also understanding the differences found when the Minnesota legislature expands upon within the Human Rights Act in those respective areas. The most common charge of discrimination which is filed with the Department of Human Rights is still employment discrimination cases. Going back and taking a look at information within the department the last 15, 20 years, 55% to 70% of the claims are generally employment discrimination cases. In the last 6 months, it was 60.7 as relates to employment discrimination charges. The three most common forms of employment discrimination cases in the last 6 months, disability at 28%, sex or gender discrimination at 23%, and race at 22%. In the last 4 years since I've been commissioner, the most common form of employment discrimination actually has been disability discrimination. I think a lot of the advocate stakeholders when I initially took over as commissioner were focused and they were thinking that the most common form of discrimination in the area of employment was race discrimination. But my experience has been over the last 4 years that it's really been in the area of disability discrimination.
Mr. Chair, sorry to interrupt, but that jogged something in my head. So I've read in the paper, and this may or may not be related, but I'm wondering if your office has been involved in this at all or if this has all just been in the courts where you may or may not have had a attorney who may or may not be a rogue attorney who is out filing against local businesses complaints on disability discrimination or in violation of I don't know what, but they're literally saying that if you're a disabled person, you can't get in the business, you can't get in the door, or the bathrooms aren't ADA compliant. Has that been mostly in the courts, or have any of that been brought to your attention?
Senator Dietzick. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I am aware that there have been some charges which have been filed over the last 2 years as relates for individuals seeking to ensure that the public accommodation law under the Minnesota Human Rights Act and then also under the Americans with Disabilities Act is properly enforced within the state of Minnesota. As relates to sort of rogue attorneys, I wouldn't necessarily suggest to you that I would consider their actions to be rogue, but I do want to make sure that the committee is aware that if we do feel that a complaint or a charge does not have merit on its face, that we do address and dismiss those respective complaints. Where we do find that there's allegations contained within the charge or the complaint which does have an arguable or a colorable claim, that we do initiate an investigation.
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you. And I'm not saying that that this is majority, because I do believe there are some issues where there are legitimate complaints that should be filed either with your office or in the courts. But I have heard from constituents who have had a particular attorney who has done this in several parts of the state, has threatened to sue, and then basically tells the companies, pay us $10,000 and we'll go away, or else we're filing this suit, and it brings with it a lot of negative publicity that they are not in compliant. And so in that situation, have you weighed in at all, or are you aware of that, or you're just kind of too busy with your own work to have run into that situation yet?
Senator Dietzick, Chairman Latson, members of the committee, I am not aware of a specific attorney who is going in making such charges. Having practiced law since 91 in the state of Minnesota, I wouldn't find such conduct for very small members, small percentage within the bar. It may be happening.
Senator Dietzick, I've seen the same reports that you have. Apparently there was one attorney that was having one or two plaintiffs that would go around to various establishments around the state and look for minor technical violations of the ADA or the in particular, the height of a step in the front of a door or a lip in the front of an entrance, and then would threaten to bring a claim. I don't know that it went through the Department of Human Rights, however. I think it was probably a direct threat of filing a lawsuit. And even though I think they were technically correct, right, that they had found violations, So I'm not sure how that was,
right,
how that played out in terms of the legal process or the ethics process. I don't know if there's anything going on.
No, I agree with you, and the reason I brought it up is because I think that it actually, they might have been legitimate technical violations, but I think they might not have been in the spirit of the law, and so I think it it lowers the value for, because I think there are legitimate reasons why we have this law in place, and I think it sometimes may then, you know, lower that so that everybody kind of, it just creates problems because there are legitimate reasons why we have this in place, and so that, and I'm not thinking of the word that I need, but it causes a problem for the people that are out there that truly need this law.
But it does raise another question. Commissioner, I know part of your agency's mission is to help establishments and employers know what the law is and to self-police, if you will, to make sure that they're not violating the law, an educational component to your mission. Does the agency have any staff that go out and conduct investigations without having received a charge of discrimination first to suggest how a store, for example, might not be ADA compliant and suggest to the owner that they need, or the property owner, that they need to, you know, make changes to bring it into compliance to avoid any discrimination? Or is that just on a complaint-only basis for those kinds of violations?
Senator Dietzick, Senator Latz, Chairman Latz, and members of the committee, I guess as relates to both respective questions which you asked, I will take the chairman's question first, is that we don't have staff which are specifically dedicated to go out and then do an assessment as it relates to whether a public establishment is compliant with the ADA. We'll, in such situations that someone brings a particular charge, getting to Senator Dietzick's question, is that we do seek to initiate sometimes conversations or offer a compromise or a settlement, and I'll give an example to that. A recent immigrant to the United States had opened up a restaurant, was unaware of sort of the obligations to provide someone who has a seeing eye dog an opportunity to utilize and bring the dog into the facility. We were able to reach a compromise where the store owner offered free meals to the guests that had been turned away, and that did not result in attorney's fees or the department seeking civil penalties against the employer, or in this case, the restaurant.
Go ahead and continue with your presentation, Commissioner.
Thank you.
The most common basis alleged with all this.
Could you also pull your mic forward a little bit? Thank you.
The most common basis alleged with all discrimination charges within the department, again, disability is 32%, race 22%, gender 22%, age 11%, national origin 5%. As it relates to the entire inventory, about 20% or of the charges filed in the last 6 months, a favorable result for the charging party, or the charging party withdrew the matter then to settle the respective dispute. 80% of the cases in the last, or the charges in the last 6 months, a favorable result for the respondent. The department has pursued mediation about 16% of the charges which are filed. We typically, in those situations, and I'll give an example of that, to the extent that the employee is still working for the company and they feel that they have been discriminated, that would be a case which we would try to use mediation to resolve that respective dispute. There are instances in which employers send in their response to that type of a charge that they still wish for the employment relationship to continue. And again, this is one in which we might seek mediation or have a conversation between the enforcement officer and the respective parties.
Senator
Sharon.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to make sure that I understand what you're telling me with this slide. Of the investigations that you choose to take up, of those that you pursue, only 20% result in a favorable outcome for the people that you're representing? It looks like you're losing 80% of the time.
Commissioner.
Senator Chair, Chairman Latz, and members of the committee, Senator Sharon, I guess I wouldn't characterize it that we are taking up the charge for the charging party. The Department of Human Rights is a neutral fact finder, and it is only after a determination of probable cause has been reached does the department seek to then settle the respective dispute. It's somewhat more akin to a parliamentarian or English parliamentarian type of process. The party might come to us, say that they've, and I'll give the example again, the individual who was denied use of her dog in the restaurant would come to us and she would fill out a charge of discrimination. We would then begin to process or have a conversation with the employer to conduct an investigation. We haven't decided at that point in time to contact the Attorney General's office to formally file litigation within court or go over to the Office of Administrative Hearing. We're just in the fact-finding process of gathering information. So we would not consider ourselves representing or having the state represent the charging party. We're just simply conducting investigation. So if you look at the inventory of charges which are before the department, and about 20% of the charges which are filed with the department, we ultimately conclude that there's a basis for discrimination.
I see. So of the charges, about 80% do not have a basis.
Correct. And there was a recent study, well, I shouldn't say recent, it's probably about 6 or 7 years ago. If you take a look at lawsuits which are filed in federal court concerning discrimination, it's a slightly greater number, but not much greater than sort of where we are here. It's still more likely in federal court to lose a discrimination complaint or a lawsuit than to prevail. And some of that has to do with the process of a motion called a motion for dismissal at the very beginning, a motion for summary judgment before you actually get to trial, and then actually taking the case to trial. So, and arguably there would be some that would say that the standard as relates for a charging party to prevail may also impact the likelihood of someone being successful in prevailing. So, and let me just add one other thing here, is that because the attorney fee statutes apply, and this kind of goes back to Senator Dietzick's comic, that the marketplace will pull out certain cases and they will take them either to state or federal court. So the Department of Human Rights, having conducting investigations and finding only 20% of the investigations from a marketplace standpoint for me as an attorney, feels about like the right respective area. We shouldn't have more probable cause determinations than what attorneys are seeing within the court system, because they, as attorneys, are seeing those cases in the marketplace. They're also negotiating those cases before settlement, and they also are then taking those to court. Senator, did that answer your question? You still have kind of a puzzled look there. I'm sorry.
I'd have to restate what you're saying, and I don't know that you want. We can do this now. I restate sometimes what I've heard to make sure I've understood it correctly, and I'm not sure I have. But at some level, I thought I heard you say that the private market will take a certain number of these cases out of the mix.
That is correct.
And so they can't be reflected in these numbers. So by the time you are looking at them, you're looking at a ratio that probably is 20% to 80%.
Chairman Latz, members of the committee, I'm going to simplify a number here. Let's just say that there are 10,000 discrimination complaints in the state of Minnesota. The number is actually much larger, but just for purposes mm-hmm. of this discussion, the department roughly has 1,000 of those possible 10,000. If I was to take a look at those 9,000, which actually are in the private marketplace, my guess is that you would actually see a success rate for the attorneys or the plaintiffs in those cases, which would be greater than the 20% for the department.
Then I did understand. Thank
you. Is that helpful?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Part of that, Commissioner, would be because some attorneys, when they look at these cases, they may decide it's a strong enough case. There's no value in going through the department's process. They're just going to go straight to a demand letter, and if that's unsuccessful, straight to a lawsuit, which in Minnesota you can do. Under the State Human Rights Act, a plaintiff can file a lawsuit directly without first filing a charge to recover under Minnesota statute. If you want to recover under a federal statute, the laws covered by the EEOC, then you do have to file a charge of discrimination first. And then after 90 days have passed, you can ask for a right to sue letter. But then all federal-based claims do get into the administrative process before they proceed any further. Commissioner.
In 2011, the department instituted a continuous improvement process. There are various steps that we undertook at that point in time. In December, the department was fortunate to receive one of the governor's continuous improvement awards for continuous improvement in closing respective cases. This past calendar year, the department closed 891 cases. In 2013, the department closed 790. 2012, the department closed 429, which actually was increase of over 100 cases from 2010. So the department has made steady increase as it relates to its investigators' work. The other issue as an employment attorney within the state of Minnesota for the department from a historical basis has been the ability to reduce its inventory of cases that are over a year. 2012, the department had more than 200 cases which were over 1 year. Currently, we're sitting at 31 cases older than 1 year. A lot of this has been because of the work and effort to identify, I would say, some of the easier cases or the cases in which the issues are narrowed and actually be able to bring compromise either through the charging party or respondent or to quickly state and properly state what the area of the law is in that area. I think we're also well positioned going forward to make even more progress in the next 2 years. 35% of the cases in the total inventory now within the Department of Human Rights are less than 90 days, and the number of cases in the inventory over 270 days has dropped below 20%. We do participate and collaborate with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. We've identified four respective areas in which we are going to be working with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. This goes back to the chairman's comment about training that we seek to provide to employers and to others out there. Recruiting and hiring barriers. There has been much work, and thanks to the legislature as it relates to criminal background check policies. This will be one of the areas, or the use of credit checks by employers. Protecting vulnerable workers. This is broadly defined as migrant workers, individuals with disabilities. Enforcing equal pay laws, again coinciding with some of the work which we're doing on equal pay audits. And then ensuring pregnancy accommodations are provided, again, in follow-up to some of the things which were identified in WESA's bill last year. Workforce certificates, a second broad area. Employers or state contractors that have more than 40 employees and have a contract that's likely to exceed $100,000 are required to obtain a workforce certificate from the department. Under statute, the department is obligated to get a response back to an employer within 15 days. It's not to process it, just to get a response back. We have.
May I just ask,
Senator Scherer?
Sorry, I get stuck on I wasn't listening to what you were saying now because I was still thinking about agency collaboration. To accomplish these four elements that you described, do you is this agency collaboration about education primarily, or do you engage in something, is it something called an amicus brief, if I'm using the right term, which if there is a case that's occurring that has in the private sector that you believe as an agency does create a problem for somebody, vulnerable workers, for example, or the failure to enforce equal pay, if there is some kind of class action suit, if I'm using the terms correctly, a large group lawsuit with many players in it, does this collaboration extend to engaging in an amicus kind of position on a lawsuit like that?
Commissioner.
Senator Sharon, Chairman Latz, and members of the committee, to your question, does the department from time to time get asked to join in on an amicus brief? The answer is yes. It's typically, however, not from these respective partners, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission or the Fair Employment Practice Agency. The most recent example is when the Office of the Attorney General asked for our thoughts as relates to amicus brief, which is currently being filed and argued before the United States Supreme Court as it relates to whether disparate treatment should be a viable theory in a housing discrimination action.
Okay. So it's not part of this agency collaboration initiative that you're working on specifically. It's a separate question as to individual cases that you may be requested to participate in.
Chairman Latz, members of the committee, that is an accurate statement.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Commissioner.
On workforce certificates, we have achieved 100% response rate within the 15 days. We've also really tried to focus in on processing all the workforce certificates within 15 days. 80% of the workforce certificate applications now are processed in less than 3 days, and the average length of time to process all workforce certificates now is down to 19 calendar days. And we feel that that's a proper focus now, emphasizing working with contractors to ensure maximization of equal employment opportunities on contracts and not focusing in just simply the processing of the applications. In April 2012, the department did adjust workforce participation goals. They were at 11% in the 7-county area. In Hennepin and Ramsey County, they were adjusted to 32%. In Anoka, Carver, Dakota, Scott, and Washington, the goals were adjusted from 11 to 22%. Most people are aware of sort of state multi-purpose stadium project, and I guess we heard a little bit of the capital restoration project here during my testimony. Both of the respective projects are projects which are monitored by the department. On the stadium project, 39% of the total workforce hours are being done by workers who are minorities. Female workers are accomplishing 9% of the work on that project. On the state capital restoration project, we're sitting at 37% for minority workers and then 22% for female workers.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dziczek.
Thank you, Chair Latz. I like the numbers for the minority worker. I think we're getting to good goals. Do you know why the difference in the female workers between the Capitol and the stadium is that the type of work they're doing right now? And so, you know, they're doing IAM work or something at the stadium, but what do you do the discrepancy there? Because the, you know, the minority numbers are kind of close, but there's a gap in the female workers. Any idea?
Commissioner.
Senator Dziczek, Chairman Latz, and members of the committee, I think there's twofold questions for it. Some of it is, in the question which you asked, is the type of work which is being performed. We are getting at the point in the Capitol or in the stadium project in which some of the work which is being performed, we may see greater participation for women because they are more in the apprentice and also in the talent pipeline for those respective trade positions. The work of the legislature the last session to provide additional funding under WESA to increase participation of women in those various trades will make a difference as it relates to the one particular trade that you identified and I think others. But just simply to call it out, in the iron worker area, the funding will have a significant impact. As it relates to just generally or overall as it relates to female participation, I think some of the work over the last 2-3 years has positioned us such that it may be appropriate to adjust workforce participation goals for female workers on the 7-county construction area because we are seeing more and more contractors achieving beyond the respective goals, and I think that they are also tied in a way with unions and then also training halls in a way such that the pipeline opportunities are more readily accessible to them, and they're seeing pathways to bring more women into the construction trades. To that point of sort of changing the conversation as relates to pipeline, so in the year 2010, minority participation was sitting at 11.19%. This past year, taking a look at those seven counties, we're seeing minority participation at 27.5%. A lot of this has to do with a lot of the hard work as it relates to the Department of Labor and Industry, as it relates to creating an apprenticeship training pipeline, the unions themselves, contractors reaching out to various communities. So they're to be commended for that. I think the same conversation that we started as it relates to minority workers is now appropriate to adjust the workforce goals as it relates to female workers. I think the stakeholders see how they can achieve progress.
Commissioner, we've got about 5 or 7 more minutes for the department's presentation. So.
Okay. Equal pay certificates, again, the processing is going very well. We're now processing those within 2 days. Ban the box. The key takeaway here is, from Professor Pager, is that we still have respective issues concerning how criminal background information is being evaluated by employers. We have been very intentional in our efforts to do an educational campaign outreach effort in this respective area. We've really appreciated partnering with We Are All Criminals and the Council on Criminal Justice. We've had 85 investigations initiated. The vast majority of them have been resolved without us having to go any further. We also, in the last couple of years, have been working on various executive orders to ensure that they get properly implemented. The tribal consultation policy, I think a very important one, a very important step for the state of Minnesota to create the proper relationship with 11 sovereign nations. Diversity and inclusion, this one was just recently signed. I appreciate the governor making space for me to serve as the vice chair on that respective council. We're going to be working as relates to employment within all the state government, contracting, and then also I think the civic engagement piece is very important. The Olmstead Plan, as relates to ensuring people with disabilities are properly integrated in all areas of life in Minnesota, we're working on that respective initiative. Bullying and Safe Schools Act, we have met with the Department of Education, the School Climate Center. We've worked on developing the model school bullying policy, and then also are prepared to provide additional training to schools concerning compliance with the School Bullying Act. Education to reduce disparities. Next slide. Working on interagency initiatives. These aren't directed through an executive order, but they are interagency efforts to reduce disparate outcomes. And in homelessness, again, a large number of people of color are homeless. This is one in which we're trying to facilitate communication of strategies to providers to lessen disparate outcomes. Reducing recidivism, the Department of Corrections is reaching out not only with state agencies but county government and other providers. This is one, too. We appreciate Commissioner Roy making space for us. And then I think this is the last slide here, the National Governors Association increasing alignment on education and pipeline, which I think brings us to the budget. The recommendation from the governor, an increase to our respective base. Currently, the staff of the Department of Human Rights is sitting at 40 full-time equivalents. In 1996, the department had 56 FTEs. The increase by the governor would not bring us up to 1996 levels. It would actually fall short of that. But it would allow us, I think, to properly implement the things which I've identified within the executive orders, the initiatives as relates to interagency efforts, and then also help us support the other work identified. Is that it? Sorry for not honoring your time, Mr. Chair.
No,
I apologize for that.
No, we're right on time, but okay. I do have a question for you. So the 1.8% operating increase, is that separate from the capacity building proposal?
Senator, or Chairman Lantz, members of the committee, yes, it is.
Okay. And then the capacity building proposal is the final slide, number 33, which adds 10 FTEs for conciliation, bilingual investigators, and legal analysts to coordinate the executive orders and interagency initiatives?
Chairman Lantz, members of the committee, that is correct.
And then the $900,000, presumably that would be staffing and is that like, that's obviously not the the salaries, that's the other aspects of creating space and facilitating the use of the staff?
Chairman Lantz and members of the committee, that is correct. It is beyond just simply salaries.
Any further questions or comments from members of the committee? Commissioner, thank you.
Chairman Lantz, members of the committee, thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Members, in your packet, there are some of the executive orders from the governor for your information. Okay, we will now welcome the representatives from the Uniform Law Commission for their budget overview. Senior Judge Harriet Lansing, retired judge from the Minnesota Court of Appeals and current president of the national organization, the Uniform Law Commission, and Jack Davies, who wished to only be identified as a Uniform Law Commissioner.
But I want to declare, Madam Chairman, that not everything I'm working on around here is uniform.
He is, however, the unofficial dean of the Uniform Law Commission. That would be the national and the state.
So Mr. Davies lacks a certain amount of uniformity in his in his work over here. Judge Lansing.
Chairman Lantz and members of the Judiciary Committee, I'm Harriet Lansing. As Chairman Lantz has said, a senior judge in the Minnesota Court of Appeals, a Uniform Law Commissioner from Minnesota, and currently I do serve as the president of the Uniform Law Commission. And I'm joined by Jack Davies, Minnesota Law Commissioners. Thank you for giving us time on your agenda and for your support in maintaining the strength of the Minnesota delegation in the Uniform Law Commission, which we believe is a vital part of our legislative fabric. With 137 uniform acts being part of Minnesota law at one time, and currently 80 on the books that range from anatomical gifts to limited liability companies to interstate family support and to a whole list of acts that looks sort of like a Sears Roebuck catalog that your assistant has department assistant has been kind enough to put in your files. We also have brought a copy of a book that is the history of the Uniform Law Commission that was authored by Bob Stein, who's one of the Uniform Law Commissioners. And we were prepared also to show you an updated CD, but our audio component is not strong enough to, I think, to keep your attention through that, so we're waiting for another year, and when the technology changes become sufficiently advanced so that we can do that without putting an undue burden on others.
We should note the Capitol system is incapable of broadcasting the audio of their presentation along with the video, so good thing we're updating the Capitol.
Yeah.
And I will also note parenthetically Bob Stein, the author. I assume that's the same Bob Stein that was the former dean of the University of Minnesota Law School and was it president of the American Bar Association?
He was the executive director of the American Bar Association for, I believe, a total of 12 years, and he preceded me as a president of the Uniform Law Commission as well.
And another Minnesota connection.
Yes.
And we also had one other president. Mike Sullivan was president of the national organization. So we've had three during my tenure.
Judge Davies has urged this as a method of cost savings because the president's hotel bills are paid by the organization for the one-week annual meeting. This is a great motivation to have Jack urging this. So the acts that we will be working with this year include the Uniform Trust Code, the Fiduciary Access to Digital Assets, Voidable Transactions, which was formerly termed fraudulent transfers in my days in the practice of law, and deployed parents' custody and visitation, amendments to the Uniform Limited Liability Company Act, just residual changes from last year, and collateral consequences of convictions and correction and clarification of defamation. We believe that we are a modest cost in terms of the product that we deliver and try to continue to deliver in a bargain for Minnesota and other states since 1892, because the hundreds of thousands of lawyers' hours that go into these acts is pro bono and uncompensated except for travel expenses. Minnesota's share of the overall budget for the ULC for fiscal year 2016 is $56,000 in dues, and for 2017, we can't project out quite that far. The cost for the dues will be $57,000. Travel expenses for the annual meeting, which I've indicated is a week-long session that each commissioner is required to go to, that consists of reading every act proposed for adoption line by line. For the full Minnesota delegation, brings the total to $87,000 for 2016 and $94,000 for 2017. So that's a total of $180,000 for the biennium, an increase of, according to our computations, of about 7.4% over the current biennium appropriation of $168,000. That's our overview. We're very happy to answer any questions.
We should also note that Bob Tennyson, who's a longtime representative of the Law Commission around this Capitol, is not joining us today, but Judge President Lansing mentioned to me earlier, he is chairing one of the national committees to put together a uniform law proposal, which hopefully we'll see in the next year or two.
Very enthusiastically working on correction and clarification of records, criminal records.
What's the current dues level again?
Current dues are 50. It's either 53. Do I have that? Goes. It's very close. It's 1% less about than our 54,000. So it's 53 and a bit over.
So did the national organization reduce the dues requested, or was that a budgetary decision here?
There is an anomaly in the budget figures you have for a couple of years ago. When we made up some deficits in our dues payments, otherwise it's been just a gradual increase to reflect inflation.
Well, I see. Okay.
And we were very grateful for that. What Jack calls an anomaly, in which we viewed as an opportunity to repay our obligations and to hold our heads a little bit higher in the conference.
All right. So we're going to have a couple of uniform laws coming before us. I know Senator Cohen is shortly going to introduce the Uniform Trust bill, and there may be some others coming along this year as well.
The Uniform Trust bill has really been very carefully scrutinized and vetted by the Minnesota State Bar Association. And it's really quite an excellent bill in bringing Minnesota into the mainstream on trust, and at the same time actually is putting us out a little bit ahead of the mainstream, because it is looking at decanting trust, which is a very interesting development, which I hope will get full attention when the bill comes up before the Senate and the House, and also for divided trusteeships, which fills in a gap that has been needed across states to bring them in line with recommendations of banks and other things. So that's a very important bill, and we're happy for the collaboration with the State Bar Association. Another bill that is coming forward that I think is going to be very interesting is the Fiduciary Access to Digital Assets. I must say that our organization doesn't always do the best on naming our acts, but it is essentially what happens to digital assets when a person dies and how the family can get access to those digital assets, some of which are commercially valuable and some of which are sentimentally valuable. So that act is also going to be here, and we've had a lot of attention in that act nationally and internationally. It's been translated into Finnish and Chinese and Japanese and is sort of out on the waves.
So this would be
Chairman,
like
members of the committee. And it was brought to the conference's attention by one of the Minnesota commissioners. Gene Hennig was the main promoter of it, which is not unusual. Minnesota feeds the organization in a way that I have always been very proud of.
So this would be, for example, if a person dies and they've got a cell phone and a computer or their banking is done electronically, and how does the family get access to the passwords and otherwise so they can sort out that information?
The providers are not overly anxious to sort it out themselves, although they have come to the table to provide us information, Google, and we're still working closely with Google and Facebook and others. But it imposes a bit of a monetary obligation on them, and it's not something that they voluntarily want to undertake. So we've tried to strike a good balance on this, and we're hopeful that it's going to be successful. It's been introduced, what Jack says about its origins are true. We are a bit proud of overproud perhaps of our Minnesota delegation. But this is an act that's now already been introduced in, I think, almost 30 states. So it's moving quickly, but okay.
Here. We should catch up to technology is what you're suggesting. Right. Senator Sherrin.
Yeah, really appreciate your presentation and the work that you all do. And I just want to summarize what I'm learning so you can affirm if it's correct or not. I understand that you and there's a list of persons in the back of this book, I guess it was. I thought it was in this material. Those are not all commissioners, or are those all commissioners?
In the back of
book,
Dean
Forming
Stein's
a More
book.
Perfect Union?
Yes. That almost all of those people listed in the index are either current or past commissioners.
And there are eight. Did I read eight somewhere?
From Minnesota.
Ten commissioners.
Yes.
Anyway, those are volunteers. Those are volunteers who do all this traveling and studying of proposals that would be put in front of the legislature for Uniform Act.
Yes, that is absolutely true.
The costs of your travel are picked up by the Uniform Law Commission and paid out of the money that the states send as a part of being members of the commission. Is this correct?
For all of our drafting committees, that is accurate. The only part that the state pays in addition to the dues is our annual meeting expenses, which we're required by statute to attend.
And is the money that's in the budget going to cover all of those? Is the proposal that's coming in front of it covering all of those needs?
Chairman Latz and Senator Sherrin, yes, that's correct. And Senator Sherrin, if I may, Mr. Chairman, if I may, I would like to also extend my appreciation to the work, to the committee and to you for the work that we did last year on UIFSA, because Congress did pass the Family Support Act. And so now the legislatures around the country are scrambling to try to meet that very, very tight requirement. And in Minnesota, all we have to do is change the line for the effective date, thanks to the work that you did last year.
Mr. Chairman, I think for a lot of people, the Uniform Laws Commission is really a puzzling kind of thing. And I think if I can take 1 minute to explain the character of the commissioners around the country, you'll understand. The commissioners are all lawyers. They're all looking for an opportunity to do some part of their life in the public interest, and they're all workaholics. And this is just a wonderful combination.
And Senator Latz, may I ask, do you struggle to find people to be these commissioners, or how does, if somebody wants to be a commissioner, how do they participate?
In every state, there's a state law that provides how people will be appointed, and it varies tremendously. Some states have just the governor, and they're just a significant variety. In Minnesota, it's the governor, the attorney general, and the chief justice jointly appoint the three appointed members. And we have a statute in Minnesota that says after you've been a member for 20 years, which under the conference constitution is also a provision for life membership. And the thing is, in Minnesota, we haven't had anybody die for we have a fair number of life members, plus the revisor of statutes is ex officio.
It really is it's a recognition also of the significance of these individuals' contributions to the law and their expertise in the fields of practice as well, that they are esteemed highly enough to participate in this national project. And we are grateful for your participation, and we know that you honor us in your work on the national level. So thank you for doing that.
Chairman Latz, thank you very much. And on behalf of the commission, we thank you. And I would also add to that we do from time to time have openings among the commissioners, and we are always looking for excellent recommendations that will join us in this work that we consider really a privilege to do, and a privilege when we get an opportunity to come to the legislature and see the types of consideration that you give the things that we have been watching as we waited here this afternoon.
Thank you. That's a fine note to conclude our proceedings on. Thank you both of you for your presentation and for your work. There will be no further business to come before the Finance Division.
Thank you.
Judiciary, we are adjourned.